Now, sometimes you read a line in a piece of writing that makes you stop and think. Here's one from an essay in a recent architectural review on architectural responses, that very topical idea of repair. It says this: repair is always a question of what it means to break, who is breaking, and who is broken. That's intriguing. So we thought, let's have a chat with the author. She is a postdoctoral research fellow in architectural theory and creative practice at the University of Melbourne. Lucy Benjamin, welcome.
Hello.
Repair, it's a powerful idea, and it picks at a lot of assumptions in our culture.
Yeah, I mean, I think repair is something that we associate with our homes and our families. Repair is what our parents do when our school clothes rip. Repair is what we do on the weekends when we've got spare time. But increasingly, repair is something that is absent from our lives because it's easier, faster, quicker, better, nicer to buy new things.
Well, it's more than just an absence, isn't it? I mean, obsolescence is something of a cornerstone of capitalism.
It is. Planned obsolescence is absolutely a cornerstone. And I guess obsolescence operates in different ways. So often we think about planned obsolescence as the way in which phone upgrades occur, and suddenly I need to buy a new phone if I want to play this game still, or snakes no longer fossil because phones don't operate in that same way, and so we have to get new things if we want to continue to have the same leisure habits. But there's other ways in which obsolescence occurs. So one of the things that pushed me to think about this topic was when my bike wheels were stolen last year. I left my bike on campus over the weekend, which was perhaps I was asking for it. And I came back and both of my wheels had disappeared. And so I rang up a couple of bike shops and I said, I just need to buy the wheels. Nothing else, just the wheels. And I was told that the bike that I had bought a year before was now on sale. It was down to $750. But it would be $650 to buy two wheels. And they were like, $650 for the wheels, you're going to have to then pay for us to put them on. This is just for the materials. So you could just buy the bike again. And I thought, that cannot be. The frame, the handlebars, the pedals is only $100. And so I was faced with a situation where the literal object is repairable. Mm. Obsolescence isn't particularly written into a bike. You know, I can keep on buying wheels, tires, etc. But the cultures around it have made repair obsolete. And so that's what pushed me into this and forced me to rethink the ideas of what is obsolescence, what is repair, and then what's that other thing in between the two? What's the repairability of this object?
It's such an interesting example too, because that is a bicycle. That's a world in which we readily associate with repair, with fixing stuff, with, you know, tinkering. That's part of that bicycle culture. So for that to be part of the paradigm there is, well, that's disturbing.
It's disturbing, but it's also, I think it's compelling because it makes us realize that we need to expand our realm of thinking. Mm. And I guess the other part with the bicycle is that although we do associate it with tinkering and fixing a puncture and all these other things, I don't know if it's shameful to admit, but I didn't know how to put a wheel on a bike and bring it into the gears and the cogs and the chains and all these other things. So we've also lost this whole wealth of knowledge that we assume is, oh yeah, whatever. But actually, these aren't things that are accessible to most of us anymore.
Tell us about, and you mentioned this man in your essay, cultural heritage historian Wilfrid Lipp, and his idea, and this is back in 1993, of a repair society.
So this is kind of the ideas that I'm talking about, is that we should live in a society where we have access to the peoples and the materials and the modes of sharing, you know, knowledge about those things that will facilitate repair. And so Lipp kind of thought we should be moving towards this. This should be the future. It shouldn't be the future of obsolescence, which is where we were tracking towards at that time. And it was this idea that, you know, if we have all this potential and these capabilities and these modes of interaction and we have all these communication channels, why aren't we using them to facilitate greater repair?
Hmm. What did he think? What did he suggest?
I mean, I'm not going to be able to remember Lipp verbatim.
it's not necessary.
but I guess he encouraged us to push back and to challenge those systems of design that were increasing us or moving us towards obsolescence. So it's about being creative design thinkers and creative users of design objects.
You talk about an ideology of cheap nature. that feeds into that. Explain what you mean by that term.
So I have full credit to Jason Moore. Jason W. Moore is the man who coins the idea of cheap nature. And it's this sense that we have that any material we have access to and we can keep on using up. So if we think about the disposability of objects, it's because, well, nature's cheap. The materials we use to make this thing is cheap. So we can buy a disposable cup and throw it away because it doesn't matter. The natural materiality of that object is suddenly not visible. So if I look at my mobile phone, that's not a natural object. Mm. And yet it is.
The objects within that, as you say, are
there are
invisible.
Hundreds of minerals within that object. It was extracted. And that nature is not cheap in any sense. There's the labor that goes into it. It's the fact that it's we're using it up. These things aren't renewable, right? They exist in the Earth's core and we're going to extract them. They'll run out at some point. So it's this kind of false ideology or this fiction or this cognitive dissonance that makes us think that the materials out of which our objects are made are cheap.
And we have a duty, knowing that, to make these things endure. Several duties. The duty to the people who have suffered through the extraction of the stuff that goes into it, a duty to the environment, which is potentially put into a state of disrepair by the throwing away of that object. This is a lot of duties on us, on our behaviour.
Yeah, for sure. I think there's an imperative to repair today, and there's an imperative to think beyond the kind of what I certainly learned at school, which was recycle. We'll recycle this, we'll break it down and we'll take those components apart and use them in other ways. And recycling, of course, is a fantastic thing that we should do, but we should also think about how we can reuse objects in their current form, right? Maybe we don't need to strip out and weaken these materials, but maybe there's a way that we can adaptively reuse something. So take it into a new life without stripping it back.
And there is a shift here. Across Europe, we're seeing the adoption of financial incentives towards repair. In this country, we had a Productivity Commission report on the right to repair. So there are moves afoot.
There are certainly moves afoot. So Europe, in many respects, from government legislation, is leading the way.
Give us some examples of the sort of thing.
So France was the first country in Europe to adopt what's called a repairability index. So the same way that in Australia we have energy efficiency and water efficiency stars on our washing machines or our white goods, in France, as of January 2021, all products sold after that date, well, products within five categories, so we're still limited, will have to have a score out of 10 for how repairable they are. So that's a really interesting thing because then we can make informed decisions as consumers and we can have that kind of transparency. And then there's other things happening across Europe with rebates. So if I take my jeans to get repaired or my bike or whatever it is, governments in Germany and in Austria will give you 50% back up to 200 euros per item for your repaired object. So those are some ways in which we can have relatively minor, I mean, these are still small objects we're talking about, up to 200 euros repair, but I think it's an interesting paradigm shift. So the other thing that France has done is they've got qualified repairers, so people who are recognised as having this knowledge. So it's not simply to say, oh, let's all embrace repair and then suddenly we'll all learn how to fix things, because that's not necessarily what we're saying. It's about diversifying an economy, having more small labourers, more small businesses that can do this repair and are recognised and able to do it in a sort of protected way.
Yes, I mean, repair at one level sounds a bit hokey and crafty. It's very cute and it's all about darning needles. But as you say, this is really changing some fundamental social pillars.
Yeah, totally. It's something that craftspeople are doing in different respects. Although, I mean, I would say that there are interesting sort of small grassroots operations that will encourage consumers or users to repair their own objects. So the main resource that we have there is a US-based website called iFixit. And iFixit was started by two friends in 2003 who realized how complicated it was to take apart an object and fix it. And so now they... Because it's impossible. We often look at objects today, if we look at our smartphones, we'll need very particular screwdrivers. You can't just use a flathead on these things. Like, they are very precise. And so this is something that impacts the repairability of that object. If I don't have that readily accessible screwdriver, I can't repair this. And so iFixit do what they call teardowns. And as a member of the community, you can upload a video of you doing a teardown, where basically you take apart that object and you show how easy it is or how impossible it is. And then you give that object, much like the French government, a score and a repairability index. And then you can go on iFixit and I can say, I've got whatever object. I can look up whether someone else has done a teardown, and then I can follow their steps and how to repair it. I can go onto the website and I can buy a repair kit. So it's trying to encourage us to be, as you say, careful users.
It's not just, though, is it, the not having the right screwdriver is one side of this equation, but the sort of statutory legislative impediments to actually repairing stuff is another level altogether. And that's where the Productivity Commission in this country was looking at those barriers to repairs and trying to find a way to create a right to repair.
There's definitely lots of issues from a legal side of things, and I'm not a lawyer, so I wouldn't presume to know them all. There's a fantastic repair research centre at Griffith University that's doing lots of work from copyright, intellectual property lawyers up there looking into all of these questions. But the main hurdle that they're identifying is that manufacturers have issues around safety and the security of users' data. So as things are increasingly smart objects, my smartphone has all of my personal details on it.
My smart kettle,
my smart fridge, all of my smart things. Suddenly, if I just tinker and repair it, I get some guy in the street to do it, then maybe my personal data is at risk. That's what the manufacturers are saying, is they're saying you need to have authorized repair. But it seems like, you know, there's not actually that much private data on a smart fridge. So there's room to push back and to rethink exactly what's at stake here, I suppose.
I'd like to turn this to architecture. This is where this, I think, becomes a really complex and intriguing conversation, as you write. Ideas, how are they shifting in that discipline?
I think the discipline is realising that it has a responsibility to think about repair. You know, the construction industry is one of the most environmentally damaging industries.
You state that it contributes 38% of global greenhouse emissions.
Yeah, that's what it's recorded. It's one of the main contributors to waste, construction demolition waste, old bricks, old floor, old lino, all these sorts of material objects, all these bits of cheap nature that we have. And so there is a kind of struggle within the discipline, I think. On the one hand, we've got this need to critically think about repair. And so on that side, we've got the work of Charlotte Malte-Ebert, who in 2020 called for a moratorium on construction, followed up in 2023 by Joe Giddings, who called for a moratorium on demolition, right? Saying we simply can't build anymore. So that's one side of it, is saying let's really think through critically how we can adaptively reuse, retrofit and repair our building stock. And then on the other side of that, in the construction industry, we've got housing shortages. We've got a very financialized housing market where these aren't simply objects that we might repair and dwell in, but these are sides of revenue. These are investments. So we've got a desire to keep on building because that's how we can make revenue.
Plus the overwhelming architectural impulse to make the shiny and new.
And I think increasingly the shiny and new is beginning to show its wear. It's suddenly, you know, it's not so compelling, I think, to many people in the discipline. So, you know, major winners of the Pritzker Prize, which is the key architectural award in 2021,
yeah.
Lacaton and Vassal, two French architects, are renowned for their repair work. And this is being recognised by leading bodies.
How important has a feminist literature around building and repair been in this change?
I personally think that, and many others do, that feminist literature has been pretty key here. So in my work, I've drawn a lot, although I'm based in a design school, I've drawn a lot from the work of the feminist theorist Eve Kosofsky-Sedgwick. And in the 1990s, she was writing against what she saw as a culture of suspicion, right? That it's always going to be this way and there's always going to be violence. The marginalized will always be marginalized. And so we've got to look for the moments where we're seeing that violence occur. And I mean, that's true. The marginalized are often increasingly marginalized. But Sedgwick was saying, okay, we could take that attitude, or we could have something called reparative reading, where we could look at cultures of resistance and the way in which they sustain themselves and the way in which we have these lines of communication and support and camaraderie, and we could repair from there. So we could project forward and imagine a future society organized not around the hatred that we feel or that is that we're persecuted by, but by the things that sustain us.
Almost, though, feels like an idea predicated on collapse.
On collapse?
On a rebuilding rather than a repairing.
It definitely has that sense to it. But I suppose against the image of collapse and breakdown and disaster, which is so prevalent, especially in a country like Australia with everything we've seen environmentally, we could kind of pause and say, actually, repair's happening every day. Repair is something that I do to sustain the world. And this is also coming out of feminist literature of the 1960s. So Mila Lardy-Shukaily's positioned herself as the unofficial artist in residence of the New York City Sanitation Department. And she cleaned the steps. She made a manifesto based around maintenance and care. Said all of these things, when I put a child to bed at night, when I make a meal, when I clean out the old drawer, all of these acts are acts of care, maintenance, and repair. And I'm doing them all the time. And we could stop looking at these moments of utter disaster and always positioning repair in response to and reactive to, and instead say, actually, repair's happening all the time. It's anticipating, it's sustaining things. Let's go with that narrative. Why do we have to take the other one?
And it's interesting how that is beginning to take, I mean, big shape. In the street in which I live, there's a block of 1960s flats. They were made for sale and bought by a developer. Now, the assumption of everyone in the street is that they would be knocked over and be replaced by a thing, a modern thing. No, this block of flats was gutted and refitted, repurposed, made sustainable and re-inhabited. It was a beautiful example of honouring that original building, not for any particular aesthetic worth, but simply because it was there and making it fit for better purpose.
And that's something that's great to hear about, and we should certainly be doing more of that in Australia, because we do have this great built heritage around us and we need to learn how to inherit it. And that means not just the sandstone, but also the 60s modernists, the kind of slightly dreary and the bleak, and giving them new lives.
And not just doing it for resale, for increasing value.
Yeah, not just doing it for resale, exactly. Doing it because we have a duty to care for these buildings and to recognise that people have memories embedded within these buildings. They aren't simply static objects. These are buildings that have lives and legacies, and they've organised our living experiences.
So that takes us back to the quote that we opened with, which is the repair is always a question of what it means to break, who is breaking and who is broken. I mean, tell us about that idea.
Well, that's this idea that it's not simply, you know, a rusted pipe or a cracked wall. That's not the only broken thing. The broken thing are the systems of housing commodification that say, oh, well, we'll just push it over and make a new one, even though that'll mean extracting all this new cheap nature, even though that'll mean destroying maybe an organizing landmark in a community, even if that'll mean perhaps unhoming the people that live in that building at the moment. Like, those are all systems of breakdown in my mind. And we don't want to repair those ones. We want to break them so that we can repair something out of the livelihoods that have made buildings and communities meaningful in the meantime.
It's a big possibility.
It's a big possibility. And I think it's one that we can move towards. There are lots of feasibility studies happening from small practices at the moment, going around and looking at building sites that have been declared unrepairable or that capital has said it's not worth repairing, and saying, how could we actually repair this? How could we either disassemble it and reassemble it, or how could we stay on site and give it a new life?
Lucy, thank you. Wonderful ideas and challenging ones too.
Oh, well, thanks for having me.
Lucy Benjamin, she is a postdoctoral research fellow in architectural theory and creative practice, University of Melbourne. Now, her essay in Architectural Review is titled, In What Style Should We Repair? We'll pop a link on the Blueprint for Living homepage.
Find more great ABC RN stories that take you beyond the headlines on the ABC Listen app.